This is KYUK, public radio for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. I'm Samantha Watson. Alaska Congressman Nick Baggage yesterday urged the state legislature to be bold with policies to encourage resource development, just as a previous generation did to build the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports.
Baggage told state lawmakers to lay the groundwork for more drilling and mining and to enable the LNG gas line by adopting a favorable tax system.
The federal barriers are coming down. The permits are moving. The investment is flowing. But this window of opportunity for Alaska will not remain open forever.
In his annual address to the legislature, the Republican who represents Alaska in the U.S. House struck a tone of economic optimism and bipartisanship. Baggage rarely crosses President Trump, but he hardly said his name, even as he lauded the administration's signature policies and legislative achievements, like border enforcement and deportations.
When you enforce the law, chaos recedes. And when you weaken cartels, American communities are safer.
Last year, as a brand new member of Congress, Baggage told the legislature Alaska was too dependent on federal spending. He supported the DOGE spending cuts and said the federal budget was unsustainable. This time, he spoke more of the support he's helping to deliver. On disaster relief for Western Alaska, Baggage said he's trying to get the Trump administration to reverse course and pay 100% of the state's claim. Representative Nellie Jimmy, the Democrat who represents the region, asked what he's doing to win federal support to move and rebuild communities destroyed by the Halong storm in October. Baggage said it would take time.
But it needs to be done in a way that's durable so that people have the confidence to go back to their villages and know that they're going to be safe. And that's my commitment to those communities. That's my commitment to you. And we will work with you to find the best way forward to achieve that.
Anchorage Representative Andy Josephson was struck by how nonpartisan Baggage's speech sounded compared to that of U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan last month.
As a progressive Democrat, I found most of his speech and his tone inoffensive, and some of it welcoming.
Josephson, though, says Baggage glossed over a few harsh realities, like his assertion that Trump's enforcement of immigration law has lessened chaos. Josephson says that's not what he sees.
What's ensued has been lots of chaos, right? And real harm and real division in the country and real fear of our own federal government. So I thought that was misguided, insensitive, all of those things, but said pleasantly enough.
Baggage skipped the customary post-address press conference, but did take a few questions from reporters in the hallway. For Alaska Public Media, I'm Liz Ruskin.
In his annual address to the Alaska State Legislature, United States Representative Nick Baggage III spoke about topics ranging from the war in Iran, Alaska's mining potential, and the effects of ex-Typhoon Halong on Western Alaska. Baggage commanded the joint rescue efforts that took place in the weeks after last fall's destructive storm and addressed the region's lengthy road to recovery.
The scars will persist, and the recovery will be challenging. But my team and I continue to support recovery efforts, either to rebuild or to relocate as those communities arrive at those self-determinant decisions.
After his address, Baggage took comments from legislators. State Representative Nellie Jimmy said many from storm-displaced communities have struggled emotionally. In Anchorage, many remain in temporary hotel housing, unable, she says, to cook for themselves or grieve together. Jimmy also referenced the federal government denying Alaska a full reimbursement of funds it's used across recovery and rebuild efforts related to ex-Typhoon Halong. The state is in the process of appealing that denial.
Kipnuk and Gwiglingok have voted to relocate. Their people have made the most difficult decision a community can make. They have voted to move. But to where? With what federal funding? Right now, the answer is there is no answer.
While Quiguillengok has officially announced its pursuit of relocation, Kipnuk's tribe has not made an official announcement regarding relocation. Jimmy asked Begich III what he's doing to secure financial funding for disaster relief, repair broken communities, and prepare for the next storm. Begich responded that he supports 100% reimbursement for the state.
We don't want that doubt to persist, and so it's going to be a lengthier process than I would like or any of us would like to rebuild and relocate these communities, but it needs to be done in a way that's durable so that people have the confidence to go back to their villages and know that they're going to be safe.
Representative Begich said that following the storm, he met with displaced families in Anchorage who spoke of their fears about returning, about being just as vulnerable to a similar storm. He says he's committed to making sure displaced communities return to a safe place. The Iditarod is known for its toughness, but this year, three teams on the 1,000-mile trail to Nome are in the race's first-ever non-competitive expedition class. Two are wealthy businessmen who've contributed money to the race. One is a former champ. And despite the financial contributions, some mushers are questioning what the businessmen are doing in Alaska's Super Bowl of dog mushing. KNOM's Ben Townsend has more.
3, 2, 1, go! Ladies and gentlemen, from Norway in starting position numbers, or excuse me, from Switzerland, Gjell Roke at Iditarod, 54.
That's the sound of Gjell Roke setting off from the Iditarod ceremonial start in downtown Anchorage. Roke is the Iditarod's first billionaire dog musher. And he's involved in different businesses, but he made a lot of his money on dog food, specifically a type made from Antarctic krill, the tiny shrimp-like crustaceans. He's sponsored Iditarod mushers before and has given the race at least $300,000 this year to lower musher entry fees and boost the race purse. Roque's entry into the race is rubbing some people the wrong way. That includes Fairbanks musher Jeff Dieter, an Iditarod veteran with 6 finishes.
He's running under his own / no rules. He's swapping dogs in and out on the trail. I mean, there are things that he's doing, his group is doing, that are not representative of Iditarod and long-distance racing, and I have a real problem with that.
The Iditarod Trail Committee is the nonprofit that puts on the race, and it's struggled to stay out of the red in recent years as costs have gone up and sponsorships have declined. The ITC announced in June that Roque would join the race and was contributing financially, but race officials declined to answer questions about his entry. It wasn't until 2 days before the race started that race officials offered more information. The release said expedition mushers like Roque aren't limited to a set 16-dog team like the other mushers. They can swap in fresh dogs, aren't required to take any layovers, and can receive outside assistance in any form. And so far in the race, Roque is also mushing very close to the 2020 champion, fellow Norwegian Thomas Warner, who's supporting Roque on the trail. The race has also said expedition mushers are, quote, explicitly instructed to separate themselves from the competitive element of the race and must not interfere in any way, end quote. And it's that last part that former mushers like Iditarod veteran Aaron Burmeister are keeping an eye on. Aside from Warner's dog team, Roque is being flanked by 2 snow machines tasked with breaking trail and setting up camp. Burmeister says snow machines piloted by locals or Iditarod's video crew are common along the trail, and he says they can be a good thing, particularly if a blizzard makes the course hard to follow. But snow machines come with downsides too.
If they break the crust up and you fall through the base, now you're going from 9 miles an hour on a dog team down to 7, struggling to go through deep snow.
Defending Iditarod champion Jesse Holmes has concerns as well, at least in part related to where he plans to take a mandatory 24-hour break.
Well, I think that it's really thrown me for a loop on how I plan to run the race. I plan to go to Cripple for the 24, but apparently Thomas and Rourke, they plan to push an aggressive pace and race us to Nome and beat us to Nome.
And the Cripple checkpoint is usually quiet. It's not a community and consists of only a couple small buildings. Despite fewer amenities, some mushers like to take their 24-hour break there because it's away from hustle and bustle. Holmes says the extra snow machines are making him second-guess his strategy.
So it just adds more to the musher's plate to have to try to contemplate what they're going to do, you know?
Roque's history with the Iditarod goes back to at least 2019, when a company he owned began sponsoring Warner. Warner says he's been training with Roque for 4 years now, including a notoriously brutal section of trail along the Norton Sound coast.
I'm looking forward to see the trail again, the whole trail. But we've been going from, you know, from McGrath to Nome last year, so, you know, we've seen a lot of the trail again.
The Iditarod typically takes just over 8 days for the top teams to complete, and longer for others, meaning mushers spend a lot of time on the runners watching the dogs trot along the trail. Roque calls running the Iditarod a great adventure, but...
I'm really not a dog man, per se, but I connect very well with the dogs. You have to be in a good mood, whatever happens, smile, laugh, tell them stories, sing, and that's what I do.
Roque was the sixth musher to depart the Willow Restart, and along with Warner, lingered around the front of the pack for the opening stage of the race. On the opposite end of the procession was the only other expedition musher, Canadian businessman Steve Curtis, whose entry into the race came as a surprise just days before the start. The Iditarod did make one thing clear in its earliest statements about the expedition class. If Roque or Curtis make it to the famed Burled Arch, the race's finish line in Nome, they will not receive an official Iditarod finisher's belt buckle, but instead will win a separate expedition class belt buckle. With help from Ava White in Anchorage, blocks away from that finish line in Nome, I'm Ben Townsend.
This is KYUK News. I'm Samantha Watson. Koyana for listening. Please share your news tips, comments, or suggestions. You can email us at news@kyuk.org or message us on Facebook. And stay tuned for Yuktun Gnomchit coming up.